Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, comedian Chris Gethard talks about how he learned he could kill another human being.
I walk across the room and I hand this knife to this guy, George. And when I put this knife in his hand, two things happened. One is he looked down at it with the demeanor of an alcoholic who has just had a shot placed in front of him. And I will never forget the words he said, which is he looked at the knife and he goes, "Hello, beautiful." So this baby monitor is directly between me and George. And all of a sudden, I just hear, I could not believe the timing. My son wakes up early from his nap. And George turns and looks at me with this knife in his hand and goes, "Caleb's home?"
Today on the show, Chris Gethard shares a story about how he learned he could kill another human being. Stay close.
Hi, my name's Chris Gethard, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show or you're a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. This is my anniversary month, Chris. I don't know if I told you that, but this is it. My 11-year anniversary of Storyworthy is right now. The first episode went up in July of 2010. So this is 11 years of Storyworthy. I think you're like my number 682nd guest or 683.
That's badass. Congrats.
Thanks, Chris.
I'm coming up on 5 years of doing my Beautiful Anonymous podcast, and people will be like, "Oh yeah, you're like one of the OG podcasters." I'm like, "Not really, but
no." Well, if you want to get old school, that you're going to talk about Jimmy Pardo, Jackie Cation,
Mark Maron,
of course, Mark and Adam Carolla, but really going all the way back, it's like Pardo. I think Pardo and Jackie Cation both started like in 2006. They were the first. Well, anyway, yeah, it's cool. And you have done a lot of podcasts, I've noticed, that we will talk about. But I wanted to tell my audience that I do hope you guys listened to Shawn Palofsky last week, comedian Shawn Palofsky. I'd wanted to have her on forever because I see her at the Comedy Store a lot, and she's just a powerhouse. She commands the room, an amazing comedian. And she told a story last week about doing comedy. She got involved with the Playboy Channel, you know, but basically there was two porn stars and they do their thing and take calls and then they bring out the comedian. Well, sure, of course, it's perfect timing. You know, it's just absurd. So go back, you guys, listen to Shawn Palofsky, but not today because my guest comedian, Chris Gethard, you hear him talking here. And today he brings forth the topic, how I learned I could kill another human being. And, I think I have that in me. I mean, if something came between me and my daughter, something came between, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, that's the, I have a feeling because that is, as you will see, core to what I'm about to tell you. And I bet every parent has that moment, right?
Sure.
I'm going to tell you the story of my moment where I was like, oh, I understand.
Oh, good. Good.
This is biological. I am biologically capable of murder.
Yeah. Well, this is, and I know that you do have a child. The baby is 2 or 3?
He just turned 2 in April. Yeah.
2 is the best. Oh my gosh. That's a fun age.
He's pretty great. He's definitely a wild man, and he just got his first stitches. And I think that's part of the 2-year-old experience as well, is like he just climbs and jumps and has no regard for safety, but it's pretty awesome. And he has opinions now and speaks in sentences. He's great.
Yeah. It's like they're people.
He claims he's a big boy. I've had to explain to him, you still wear diapers, dude. So we can have the big boy conversation after that. And it's very motivating to him because he wants to be a big boy. He really wants to be a big boy.
I remember I would sit with my daughter when she was learning to use the toilet, you know, and there is this book. It's not Dr. Seuss. I think it's P.J. Eastman. And it's about big dog, little dog, or whatever. And I wrote in the book, we changed all the words to poop, you know, so that it would be like big poop, little poop. And we would, you know, so I'd actually change the text in the book and scratch it out. And she thought that was so funny. And then we would sit and read that and, you know, she would laugh. And that was part of it, her being comfortable.
I first of all, love that. And then I'm really bad with tangents. I do apologize. But I wonder if you think, I've been shocked as a young parent to realize two things about Dr. Seuss, which is one, a lot of things we remember as Dr. Seuss were actually like other authors under like Dr. Seuss's umbrella. Yeah. And B, there's like a couple good Dr. Seusses. And then a lot of Dr. Seusses, in my opinion, he just clearly had a book due and wanted to make some bank and just made up some more. He was just like, all right, the Floozles, and they go to Goozles. And that's it. And you're like, they're all the same, man. But the Lorax is great.
Yeah. And Sneetches is great. Mm-hmm. And he did All the Places You Will Go, didn't he? That's Dr. Seuss, isn't it?
I think so. But is that right? That's one of those ones where all of a sudden you go, wait, who's this other person? And it's John. And Dr. Seuss like presented it, but it kind of has a Dr. Seuss vibe. There's a bunch of those.
It's so
like
funny.
Go Dog Go. Go Dog Go is not Dr. Seuss.
Oh, wait, that was the one I'm talking about. My daughter and I it would say poop dog, poop, or you know what I mean? Go, go poop, whatever. And that, I think that's PJ Eastman, the one that did the other one with the yellow spots in the zoo, Put Me in the Zoo. Remember that one?
We haven't gotten to that one. I kind of shake in dismay anytime my son goes to the bookshelf and pulls a Dr. Seuss off. And I know this is sacrilegious to a lot of people, but I just, there's so many that have like value both like in terms of like entertainment and education. And then so much of the Dr. Seuss stuff is just like Gogots and Bobots from the Kingdom of Cloglots. And I'm like, they make me feel insane. That's the problem. They're not bad books. They just make me feel insane.
Hey, you know what is a classic, though, is Cat in the Hat. I mean, I'm just saying the graphics, it's beautiful. Sure. I mean, the pages. Mm-hmm. Now, my daughter and I brought her up on the Peanuts and Charlie Brown.
Yeah.
And so she still loves Peanuts and Charlie Brown. And I feel like that is good comedy. You know, like it actually, it's witty and it's also classic. It's, you know, and then it translates from the movies and she's got the cartoon books and she's got the figures. And so I like that world. I like the Charlie Brown world for some reason.
We're big. I've been so kind of, I find it kind of jaw dropping actually to see how well done Sesame Street is. And like even the old episodes where I go, I watch stuff that I watched when I was a kid and I go, wow, there was like a lot of thought and strategy put into this and it's funny and it charms me. And I see my son just light up, and especially Elmo, who didn't exist when I was a kid. I sit here, I watch, I go, oh, my son, like Elmo is his guy. Like Elmo, I almost feel it's like Ernie was my Letterman and Elmo is like my son's Conan. It's like that type of thing, you know?
Listen, I got to tell you, and I know you know this, but man, you hold on to these moments because they go by so quick and then your kid will never look at Elmo again. You know, like I remember Bama, my daughter was into Clifford the Big Red Dog.
Oh, my son too. My son loves it. There's one Clifford book. My son can't get enough.
Hey, listen, have you had fun during the pandemic with your son?
It's been the whole silver lining, as you can imagine, is, you know, is living the comedian lifestyle. I have for over a year now had dinner with my wife and son pretty much every night for a year straight. Mm-hmm. And it's just not a thing with what we do, you know, between being on the road and being out, like getting your material tight, like very often you just miss that. And I like knowing that even in my real life, like I'll sometimes be gone for like a 3 or 4 day stretch of a week, but that means the other 3 or 4 days I'll have pretty much totally clear to play with them. I feel like that is overall a benefit, but the silver lining of the pandemic is that my wife told me, she goes, I think you and he are just friends at a level you wouldn't have been if it wasn't this year. So
that's so sweet.
I feel lucky on that way.
And it really does help to have another person around raising a baby like that, because you freak out every second of the day because they're going to toddle into the street. They're going to fall down the steps. They're just so dumb.
And he doesn't care. He's fearless.
Oh, right? It's terrifying.
Even compared to other kids his age, I've noticed that my son, like, he doesn't, and knock on wood that this continues, and I'm sure he'll go through phases, but like, I see other 2-year-olds who throw tantrums and he doesn't really go there in that way. But he will also, like, we took him to a lake and the kid is 2 and he sprinted and jumped off the dock and he had floaties on. And my wife was swimming and realized he was about to do it and like kind of put her body in the way so he wouldn't just like go totally under. But it's like, he just sprinted off a dock and the other 2-year-old kids are terrified to do that. And he's just not scared.
Wow.
Which is cool. As a lifelong scaredy cat, I'm like very impressed. But then I also go, oh, it just means I have to have more fear because you have none.
Yeah. You know, you think you're a lifelong scaredy cat?
I'm a nervous fella. I would say I walk a weird line between like constantly, even psychologically, I've been trying to figure this out for many years with the help of professionals, but it's like I go between like a lack of self-confidence that borders on like a dedication to self-sabotage and then also though just a complete insistence on like, well, I want to do things my way and take a chance on creatively, just like, I want to just do it in a way that everyone tells me won't work and I'll just go make it work, which is actually supremely confident and like willing to put yourself in like the way of judgment and failure and whatnot. So yeah, but like, I don't like horror movies and I don't like roller coasters. So in that sense, scared.
Right. But in other words, it's a contradiction to think that you don't have that confidence because of all that you've accomplished across so many mediums. You've done a lot over a lot of platforms and a lot of mediums. You've done so many things. So that is the ultimate confidence. So your scaredy catness, you're just saying like, you're a baby when it comes to horror stuff.
And I feel like when I was 2 years old, I wouldn't have just run and jumped off a dock. And he doesn't even flip out. Like, it's not even like he's like, yeah, afterwards. Like, he just kind of like, you know, like splashes around with a look on his face. Like, yeah, like all the adults are like, whoa. And people are like clapping from the beach at this lake because they just watched a 2-year-old jump off a thing. And he's just floating around like, this is what I do, everybody. Like, chill out. Like, he's cool. He's like cool and calm and collected at this stage.
Aww.
And in that sense, he doesn't show those fears that it would have taken me like half an hour to summon the gumption to jump off that dock. He doesn't care. He's pretty badass.
What's his name?
His name is Caleb.
Aww.
We call him Cal.
And I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. We kind of decided, I forget exactly how we realized it, but we realized we both really liked the idea of Cal.
Oh, but yeah, I do too.
But we didn't feel like it was like a full-on name you put on a birth certificate. And then I felt like I used to get like chided growing up for looking a little too much like Calvin from Calvin and Hobbes. And I think I still kind of do look like a sad, old, tired version of what Calvin was destined to grow up into. So we didn't want Calvin. And then we went through all the Callahan and Callum and all these other things. We realized Caleb, you could get to Cal from Caleb. And we really liked that one.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a great name. Great name. And I haven't actually heard it, to tell you the truth. I'm thinking of all my daughter's school years and she's 14 now and I've never met a Cal. So there you go. You got an original name too.
I also get the sense that people react to it as if they're like, that's like, people will meet my kid and like other parents of other kids, like I'll see them going like, that's the name of a chill person. Like that's the kind of reaction it gets. It's like, oh, Cal, I want a guy named Cal around. Yeah. Let's have Cal around.
No, I love it. Well, this is great. And I'm so glad you're here. I am. I have to tell you, I'm just incredibly impressed with all you do. And this comedy special that you just put out called Half My Life, you did it in 2019. So this is pre-pandemic. Mm-hmm. But then you go around all these place is doing comedy that normally you wouldn't see. So like a morning breakfast, a pancake breakfast comedy.
Yeah.
And then you got your, did you do it in front of a jury or jury duty? Did you do that one?
I didn't do jury duty. I did do it in front of alligators. I did an audience full of alligators as part of the special.
Wait, are there people there too or just
no,
gators?
Just alligators. Just alligators.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah. No heckling, I hope. No heckling.
Well, there were, this is true. I do call it out in the course of the footage that a bunch of meat had been thrown on the ground to attract the alligators. And then a bunch of vultures kept flying down and stealing the meat. And it actually felt pretty similar in some ways to being heckled. The vultures kept kind of disrupting everything mid-sentence by trying to swoop in and steal that meat. And
yeah.
I didn't like it.
Yeah, it's like a coffee maker just starting up in the middle of your set, mm-hmm. you know, right on the punchline, you get hit with a cappuccino machine. Yeah. But you did do a lot of cool places, and that shows an awful lot of ingenuity.
Thanks. Well, I just wanted to, most times you see special and it's like a really fancy venue because it's kind of, you've earned it and it's a big celebration of the material. But I took cameras to 10 venues and I self-funded the whole thing because I was just really interested in just kind of like, what if I showed, like, can I make a special that shows the idea of like, yeah, I'll perform anywhere. Like the venue wants to throw a 9 a.m. pancake show. All right. If we can sell tickets, I'll do it. Like, let's do it. Like I'll rent. And you know, that thing too, of like, yeah, I used to have a show on cable and I had an HBO special, but like I land in Buffalo and I rent a car and I drive it to Detroit and I sit in traffic and that's the reality. And I kind of wanted to not make it glitzy and sort of show like, here's for like 98% of comedians, there's no tour buses or private jets. It's like,
right.
It's gritty and it's intimate.
Right.
It's small.
Well, I think it's a great idea.
Thanks.
And yeah, it's really, really fun. Hold on. What was I going to say? I edited this, so it's okay.
I think leave it in, leave in these human moments. Let them see us. They know you're not infallible.
This is
infallible. How do you say that? I'm not either.
Infallible.
Yeah.
But about thinking about the comedy special, this is 2019. The baby was born that year,
yeah,
right?
There's a lot of cute footage of him in there. He's like,
okay, because you had a newborn,
yeah,
and you're going all over the place. Yeah.
Yeah. He was born in April of 2019, and this tour was, I think, November, December of 2019.
Yeah.
So he was little, he's like 6 months old, and that's a lot of, there's a bunch of documentary footage in there of like, here's some stand up and here's me doing this. And then also like, I got to go home and disassemble a bassinet. And like, maybe that's the priority now. And like, why, you know, I think that question a lot of comedians have of like, this is the best job in the world. And my God, what a unique lifestyle that I love so much. But I don't know too many comedians who haven't had some life stretches where they just go, and why exactly did I, why did I sign up? Like, why do I love it? Like, there's a lot of other cool stuff going on too. And I don't know that I want to be like fighting with a promoter in Richmond, Virginia tonight. I kind of want to be at home.
What I think is important is to, in general, get life experience.
Yes.
And if you don't have children, you're just missing out on that aspect. I mean, it's not everything. And of course, not everybody has to have kids, but it is something that is unlike anything else. You know, you find love deep inside you. You had no idea existed. You know, you get a whole new set of emotions and you get to do things that otherwise, you know, you probably wouldn't be getting a Frisbee off the roof in an adult, mm-hmm. you know, in your adulthood, unless you have a kid. I don't know. You get to relive a lot of stuff. And I knew when I had my daughter, it was just going to be the one. And so I have been very, very specifically attuned to taking in every single step of the way. And, you know, I've always been the room parent and I started the mom's club and I was a stay at home mom, you know, and I always knew I wanted to cherish those moments. And, you know, honestly, I look back and I kind of did it. I did it right. I mean,
awesome.
To me, you know?
It's awesome.
Yeah. I feel so lucky. She never had a babysitter. She never had a nanny. She didn't go to preschool till she was four. You know what I mean? I felt like I really got the impact that I wanted. And I think that was part of being an older mom.
Yeah.
You know, because I didn't have her until I was
older.
Well,
we're older too. I was 39 when he was born and I'm 41 now. And I am with you. I'll never be one of those people that's like, you have to have kids. But I will say, like, there are certain things. I mean, you're going to get a lot more sleep and you're going to have a lot more freedom of movement and the ability to, if you want to go on a vacation next week, yeah, I guess you can just do it. I can't do that. But there's like a certain level of emotions that I never imagined. And then the other thing that I bet you'd agree with some version of is you have this like sort of indescribable reconsideration point in your life where you go, oh, so many things about my parents that confused me or even upset me that I get so much more now. And so many looks at, especially as someone who was born in 1980, I look back at like the 1980s and 90s and I go, oh my God, how did any of us survive? Because there's now all this guidance and doctor advice on how to raise a child. And it's completely contradictory to how I was raised. And you sit here, you go, oh, all these things that I didn't even realize like informed me so much, and things that happened growing up, the way teachers talked to me, the way school taught me, where I go, oh, so much of my life I didn't even know has been like a reaction against certain things. And now I have this chance to go, and now this guy's not going to have to put up with any of that nonsense because I'm going to make sure he, and you sit here, you go, oh, I'm like reexamining like the prior generation's actions. I'm reexamining all these things that have never actually been crystallized thoughts in my head up until now. And you get to pass it on. It's really cool. It's really cool. And I'm trying to be as hands-on as possible with it. Cause it's like, I'm like you, one and done. I'm not trying to.
Good choices. These are good choices you're making. I got to tell you, I'm a little bit older than you, about a decade older than you. And I'm not kidding you. In the 70s, I grew up in the 70s, there was something known as kids were to be seen and not heard. That was a real thing.
Yeah.
Like nobody listened to kids. Like my father and my mother, they never went to my school. There was no room parent. They didn't know my teachers. You know, there was like one open house a year and that was it. There wasn't, you know, there was no guidance because they didn't have the wherewithal. They just knew to like evolution wise, push them out. And my parents were Catholic, or we grew up Catholic. Yeah. So it was very, just put them out. But it wasn't about raising them. It was just birth them.
Yeah. I grew up Catholic as well. And it's like birth them and then make them feel like everything is bad and they'll get in trouble for everything.
That's wild.
It was,
and you carry it with you your whole life. And it's unbelievable.
Yeah. It's really that whole thing, that whole side of things. I'm happy that I've moved on from religion in my own life. And I'm so happy my son is not going to be in like a guilt driven culture, just a guilt and celebration of pain and suffering culture. Just like, no. That stuff messed me up. That stuff messed me up bad.
Me too. My dad used to say, God gives you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and you can't give him an hour on Sundays? Well, yes, you can. And, you know, we had to sit in the pew 10 minutes before Mass started because our dad wanted us to, like, get into the feeling of it or something. It was just so crazy.
I mean, my parents, I grew up 3 blocks from a Catholic church. My parents went to the school there. They sent my brother and I to public school. It was like a last minute decision. They were going to send us there, but like my parents met at that school. My grandmother was a teacher at that school. My other grandparents were Irish immigrants who were at church, not just on Sundays, like multiple days a week, every wedding, funeral, everything I ever went to. I don't think I went to a wedding or funeral that wasn't at Our Lady of Large Church in West Orange, New Jersey until my mid 20s. Like it just was such a piece of me. Yeah. I look back on that. I go, I don't even go to church on Easter anymore. I don't even go.
Yeah. Oh, me neither.
That's what it takes.
Yeah. And if it's a wedding and it's a Catholic wedding, I will see you at the reception.
Oh, really?
I'm not giving you my life. My time is all I have. It's valuable. And sometimes I get like, I mean, I haven't been to a church since I was 15 because I think, frankly, it would explode if I walked in. But let's just say, you know, I'm in there and then I would start hearing, you know, all those, because it's always rote, right? The mass is the same every week, whether in whatever language all over the world, Catholic masses are the same. And when I start hearing all those words, I think it would give me a panic attack. Just because it would put me back so fast. Mm-hmm. I mean, even now, I will go to prayers. If I'm in a bad situation, I'll just go to Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Like, I'll go to that. Even now.
It's in there. I know that when we, because we're older, and having a baby when you're older can be stressful, you know? Like every doctor's visit, you sit there and you go, are we getting good news or bad news today? And I found myself with this compulsion I didn't expect to start going to mass again. And I realized not even going to masses. I went to a few masses on Sundays, but if I was like, because I was still living in New York at the time, and you know, you just walk past churches. If I walked past a Catholic church and the door was open, there were a few times where I just ducked in and said a prayer to the Virgin Mary, because I'm going, wow. You have this like major cog of my religion who's a woman and a mom and define, you know, like birthed God in a manger. And you, like, I'm, and I never forget two aspects of it. Was one, my wife, who was not raised Catholic, one Sunday I woke up, I went, I think I'm going to go to church. I just feel like it after all these years. And she goes, okay, I get it. And I get you're figuring this out, but don't. Please don't give them money because they hate women. And I was like, okay, right? And then I'm not kidding you when I tell you, I think I went 3 Sundays in a row, and it was on the third week. It was right after that news came out that like every priest in Pennsylvania had ruined at least 2 young lives. Like, and I'm just sitting here like, you guys, you don't make, even when I feel like, okay, I'm starting to understand the function of this community and this role. And you're like, okay, this is why I have my brother went Episcopalian. I have a few friends in my life who are like, oh, if you still can't let it go Episcopalian. It's the same thing, but they're not mad at women and gay people. And you don't have thousands of years of things to answer for.
You know, when we had our daughter my ex and I had our daughter 14 years ago, we went back to church and we went to a Presbyterian one because I thought for some reason my head was around a community, a baptism, like a thing.
Hard to let
and,
go.
It lasted over a year. Mm-hmm. But then now that's behind me as well. It's just, I guess it's just, you never stop learning and being curious is not a bad thing.
And the Catholic thing, I think, is very real for a lot of us, which is like you are taught that there is an entity in the sky who sees everything you do and is mad anytime you do something wrong. Like that's it's a weird thing to tell a kid. And then I don't know your background either, but I also have the thing too where it's like both of my grandparents from Ireland and my grandfather was from Northern Ireland in like a county. I visited his county. I did shows in Ireland and I drove on the island. I drove up to, I saw his village. And it was extremely meaningful to me, but there, his last name was Kelly and there used to be a Kelly's pub. And I met these elderly women in this tiny little rural village and they heard my accent. They asked me what I was doing there and I explained and they go, oh, we can show you Kelly's pub. And I said, I heard it's not around anymore. And without missing a beat, they go, I swear to you, the one woman turns to the other and goes, he's talking about the Kelly's pub that got destroyed in the bombing. You're talking about the one where there was the machine gun killings. And I'm like, okay, so like, there's also a part of me that sits here and goes,
oh my God,
Catholicism really screwed my head up so bad. And I think past couple of weeks, these Catholic bishops are trying to like condemn Joe Biden. And I sit here, I go, of the gall. The gall of this organization to shake their finger at anybody in 2021. But I sit here and I go, my grandfather left his home when he was 18 and like never saw the majority of his siblings again because he had to flee because he was Catholic. And you sit here and you go, can I totally let that go? because that's a major sacrifice that led to me having this great life. How do I totally let that go?
Yeah.
Who knew we were going to talk about this?
Well, the good news is you're not going to pass this on to your son. He can't absorb your thoughts and feelings about this. Like my daughter, she can't absorb. Every once in a while, I'll say, hey, you know, Bama, when I was your age, you know, we had to go to, and I'll say stuff like that. And she'll just laugh because she doesn't.
Yeah.
She doesn't get what that was, you know, and I don't want her to. I really don't. I just want to enjoy her life. You know, that's what's important.
Now, I will tell you one thing I really like about your show, because I told you before we recorded, I went and listened to a few of them as research. And what I really like is you're such a thoughtful person. And we just went down this like philosophical, religious sidetrack. And then it's a storytelling show. And listening to it, it feels like it has a very NPR vibe. And then occasionally you drop a well-timed curse word and it makes it even more accessible. And I really love it. And I say that with high complimentary praise, where I was listening to it and I went, oh yeah, this is like as good as that style show, and but then also completely unpretentious and accessible, and I like it.
Well, thank you. That's a huge compliment from you, because you have worked so thoroughly with NPR, with This American Life, and they actually, NPR has referred to Chris Gethard, ladies and gentlemen, they referred to him as one of our great cultural commentators on comedy tragedy juxtapositions.
Boom.
That is so kind. What an amazing thing to say.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. That one felt good.
Really cool. Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. Well, I do think that storytelling can be like very mothish or like the moth, or it can be very NPR-ish. But for me personally, is my interest is in comedians. I'm a comedian. I love stand-up. For me, it's like my head is always with stand-up. And I just have so many comedian friends now in my life. And I like that. I like comedians. So that's the difference in terms of not being like the moth. It's just, in my opinion, at a different level, because comedians think so quickly. Yeah. You know, we're always kind of much further ahead, so we don't have to sit through a lot of the precursors. We can get to the meat of it, and then swearing is just normal. And I'm curious if somebody doesn't swear, like what? How do you emphasize that?
I'm with you. I'm with you. I like it.
All right, listen, we're going to get over to your story, how I learned I could kill another human being, in just a second here. But I wanted to remind everybody that, first of all, Storyworthy is now with Podcast One, which is a huge podcast network, and I'm very grateful to be on that network. And Story Smash, the storytelling game show, you know, we're on a break for the month of July, but we will be back live at the Hollywood Improv in August. So, Chris, if you are around, I've got to get you on Story Smash, the storytelling game show. We play once a month at the Improv. We played for 3 full years, and then the pandemic.
Yeah,
we're finally getting back, and it's just such a great show. You guys go over to storysmashshow.com and get more information and updates, and also follow Story Smash on Instagram @StorySmash, and yada, yada, yada. You know that. All right, you guys, he's here right now. You've heard him talking, Chris Gethard. He is a comedian and an actor and a writer, and you've done so much great work on all the shows I love, like The Office, Parks and Rec, Inside Amy Schumer, Space Force, which is my daughter's favorite show.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, does she love Space Force? And then you were on HBO's Crashing, which I adored that show. I thought that was so well done. The Pete Holmes.
I think I had a little bit on the last episode. I felt good about that. I do. A lot of people might not recognize my name, but they'll go, I've seen that guy for 30 seconds on a popular sitcom. Okay.
I did love Crashing. Great show.
Yeah.
And you've done a lot of podcasts. You continue to do a lot of podcasts. Of course, there's the Beautiful Anonymous show, which Beautiful Anonymous makes me laugh. You've been doing it for, like you said, almost 5 years. It's been around. It's very popular. The tagline is, it's one phone call. It's 1 hour. And there's no names, no holds barred.
Yeah.
And every week you open the phone line to an anonymous caller, and you, Chris Gethard, you can't hang up first. That's,
yeah. That's it. That's all the rules.
Funniest hook in the world. You
Thanks.
Won't hang up.
But you know what? I thought it was going to be a lot of like comedy fans pranking me, because especially when I launched it, my audience was like a very like sort of like, you know, I've always had kind of roots in the more Brooklyn side of New York comedy. So a lot of like the artsy troublemaker kids like me and the punk rock people and whatnot. But my first episode miraculously got featured on This American Life, and it was a little more serious, and it sent the show in this direction that I feel like you and I are kindred spirits, because people will call up and tell me stories from their life that are at times like so dark or heartbreaking, and it's taken on a life of its own. And I feel like your listeners might appreciate that maybe more than even a lot of the comedy stuff I've done, because it's all based on just like, let's get some raw stuff out into the world, man.
It's so personal, and you're such a good listener. You know, when the call starts, you know, you just hear somebody pick up a phone line, and your voice, by the way, Chris, you know this, is like butter.
Oh, I hate my voice.
Oh, you're crazy. Your voice is amazing. It just is. And so you say, you know, hello, oh, hi. You know, just so soft and so sweet. And then the person will be like, oh, hey. And it almost sounds like I'm eavesdropping. Like, I don't even know if I should be listening to this, because it's really interesting. You don't acknowledge the audience, right? So it's just two people in a conversation. There's no, like, you don't break the third wall, as
yeah,
it were.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a great show. You guys go over, figure that out wherever you want, or listen to that wherever you listen to your podcasts. It's really very interesting. Again, it's called Beautiful Anonymous. And then you do a few other podcasts, one called New Jersey is the World. Mm-hmm. And in New Jersey is the World, you guys break down Jersey into very minuscule topics.
Yeah.
Very minuscule. Yeah. So you'll do a show about shopping, but not the shopping malls. That's a whole different episode, you idiot. You know, wait, it's not, is it just you? You have some friends there, right?
It's me and another comedian named Don Finelli, and then two friends of mine from high school who are legit not in the entertainment industry. One of them is a construction worker who is currently building runways at the Newark Airport.
Sure.
It's not,
sure,
that it's not a bunch of comedians. Yeah.
I love it so much. It's really funny. There are so many comics from New Jersey. It seems like there's a lot of people from New Jersey in LA in the entertainment industry.
Yeah. Well, I think especially in comedy, it breeds a real chip on the shoulder growing up in Jersey and an anger. And when you learn how to direct that creatively, I think comedy is a very good fit for the type of resentment that we are.
Well, also, it's
required to have.
It's the same as the Boston comics, Pittsburgh, Philly. I mean, there's just this down to earthness where it's like, you've seen it all. You get it. You can't fool us. Like, we see through it all, because we're like salt of the earth. You know, it's like those regions are just very deep-rooted Midwestern, even if it's not in the Midwest. I mean, you're on the East Coast, but it's still Midwest, as it were.
It's very, it's definitely an overall blue-collar place. And
blue-collar,
It's also like the universally the butt of so many jokes and kind of so mocked and scorned that you grew up here and you're just like, well, I guess if nobody likes us, we won't like anybody. And then we just become sort of a very angry, motivated lot.
That's very funny. It's like the folks in Cleveland, you know, the mistake on the lake. What can I say? That's always been a contentious with Pittsburgh for sure. And then you've also had a lot of different books. Like, you authored the book Weird New York, a book that detailed the ghost stories and urban legends of New York City. That sounds like it took some research.
Yeah, I started when I was young. There's a magazine in New Jersey called Weird New Jersey. And it started as like a homemade fanzine these two guys made. And it's become a real cultural institution in Jersey. So I started working for them for a little over 4 years. My full-time job was just to be their like errand boy, basically.
And like an editorial assistant or something.
and like picking up boxes at the warehouse and dropping them off at bookstores and entering names on mailing lists and like real grunt work, you know, packing up orders, taking them to the post office, and then also just writing a lot and making a thing. And I think it really to this day informs why I like to do so much of my stuff sort of like self-controlled and self-funded and DIY style, because I just watched them. I just feel like that is an idea that if you pitch, if somebody was like, why should I give you my money? What's your idea? And you said, I want to write a magazine about haunted trees in New Jersey. They would not give you money, but it's a wildly successful thing in Jersey. And it led to a whole book series, and they put me in charge of Weird New York. And I co-wrote a bunch of the other books, and a lot of people like they sell them in the Barnes and Nobles, and they're like a coffee table book series. There's weird, you know, there's almost all 50 states have one. And I really helped. I was like there in the early days helping to kind of build that whole thing. And yeah, I've lived a strange life.
So that was the first one then. Weird New Jersey was the first one.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would have thought it had been like Weird Florida. That might have been, you know what I mean? There must be one of those, right? Is there a Weird Florida?
Weird Florida is one of the better, I would say, out of the book series. It's one of the heavy hitters for sure.
It's got to be.
There's a lot of stuff going on down there.
It's got to be, because that would be like a great gift, you know, even if you don't know people in Florida. It's just funny, you know? Yeah. Oh, I could see that. That's awesome. And then you had a self-help narrative called Lose Well, published by HarperCollins. So that's a big deal. And we're going to get your story in 2 seconds, but what does that mean? The self-help narrative. What did that mean? Lose Well.
So I did my HBO special, and my HBO special was produced by Judd Apatow. And it was like pretty honest look. And I'll maintain that I am proud to say that I think there are legitimately a lot of really funny stories in it. Like it's comedy, and I worked hard to make sure it's comedy, but it's all comedy that really focuses on. There were a couple years there where I really lost my mind and really was in a dangerous place. So it focused on that. It came out in 2017, and there was an editor at Harper One who was very taken with it and said, I want you to write the book version of it. And I said, I don't want to dwell on the depression forever. And I also kind of feel weird making money. Like, I don't want to just keep commodifying depression. Like I've seen people who do that, and I trust that they're like very driven, that that's their lifelong cause. But for me, it felt like it would be, I'd like to think that I'm a comedian and I've done other things too, and I don't want that to be my sole thing. He goes, well, why don't you just write something that comes from your gut then? And I said, well, if you still want to give me a book deal, I'm happy to do it. And I basically wrote a thing from the perspective that I think a lot of comedians have, which is, you know, I think comedians are acquainted with the fact, you know, you're going to fail a lot more than you're going to succeed. And every time you see somebody who's successful, the large majority of the time, that person has stories about really profound failure as well. So the book kind of focuses on that. It's like kind of a lot of narrative stories that are all in the goal of kind of demonstrating that failure is a very necessary element if you want to get anywhere creatively.
Sure. Yeah, I agree, because it's your perspective. So how can you expect people to just jump on board with everything you're thinking, because they're different people? I mean, if you really want to get down to it, you know, it makes sense that it would be troubling, you know, that there is rejection. There has to be, because it's subjective. It's art, you know, there's not really a choice. But that being said, that's just one book. And so it's just one, I would think that maybe you would have thought to the publisher, like, yeah, or maybe that is how it ended up. Like, yeah, let me just put this in one little place and I'm done. I'm moving on. I don't need to talk about it over and over, but it's nice to have it, like, you know, filed away, as it were.
Yeah. And it's like the HBO special takes on the depression stuff. And then he was very kind to be like, well, I just really like you, and I feel like you have a way of saying things that makes sense. So let's,
I love that.
Yeah. It's not a failure is not a happy topic, but compared to suicide, it's a little bit lighter, you know. It's not like that. So he was able to let me give it a shot, and I'm I'm lucky to say that I did.
Yeah, no kidding. I love that. I'm going to find that, Lose Well. I'm going to find it. All right, you guys, listen, you can find Chris over at his website, chrisgeth.com. Then also follow him over there on Twitter, at Chris Gethard. Wherever you are, folks, put your hands together for the very talented Chris Gethard.
So we mentioned that my son was born in April of 2019, and I learned that I could kill another human being in December of 2019. It's, you know, it's the type of thing that you always wonder about. You watch movies where people are just like killing each other. I'm like, I wonder if I had to, if I would have what it takes. And I definitively, I had a moment where I knew I might have to, and I will. And I'm not even overthinking it. I'm not even feeling bad. I lived in New York City for 16 years. And in New York City, I think everybody knows there's like a trope, right? There's the trope of the Christmas tree sales. And I think anybody who's ever watched like a Christmas movie set in New York knows exactly what I'm talking about, let alone if you've been through New York, which is there's these people and they come, a lot of them just come down from Canada. And these Canadian guys, they sleep in a van for a few weeks next to the trees. And that's where you go and you buy your Christmas trees. That's how New Yorkers get Christmas trees, from like itinerant Canadians who live in vans. That's true. And you can look it up. That's who most of these people are. And I've been doing that ever since I got together with my wife. My wife loves a Christmas tree. She loves a real Christmas tree. I grew up with an artificial Christmas tree. And then when I was a young man, me and my like slovenly roommates, we weren't running out getting Christmas trees, but my wife, every year we got the Christmas tree. And this means I would get the tree and we'd buy it. And, you know, and it's charming. They cut the end and they put it in that weird orange net. And then I would sling it over my shoulders and we'd kind of schlep it back to wherever we were living at the time. And I'd be covered in pine needles and sap. And I think you can tell, like, it was a little bit of a pain. And in 2019, it was going to be an even bigger pain because we had a baby. So my wife went out, we went out and we picked out our Christmas tree. And in New York too, it's one of those great things about New York, which is you can get almost anything if you just start walking. You know, you just start walking in New York, you'll find what you're looking for. If you, whatever weird thing you want to buy a Razor scooter, just start walking. Somebody will be selling a Razor scooter. You know, I lived in Queens, like literally some store will be selling any random thing you can name if you walk far enough. And we had the baby in the stroller. And about three or four blocks from our house, found a couple different little setups of people selling Christmas trees. And one of them had two magical words that I loved so much, which was free delivery.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, every year we're doing this thing and my wife's helping me with the tree and I'm all cracked out by the end and tired. And then you got to set the thing up and I'm sitting here going, free delivery. We got the stroller with us. We won't be covered in stuff. It's like, you know, you have at that point, what, 5-6 month old baby. It's like you already have enough mess in your life, enough exhaustion. You don't need to be lugging a tree that's taller than you and then creating that mess too. So I walk up to the guy. I go, hey, it's free delivery, huh? He goes, yeah, if you live in the neighborhood. And I told him I lived about 3 blocks away, gave him the address. He said, yeah, that's in our free zone. So just tip our guy out. I said, cool. And we picked out our tree and they set it aside. And the guy said, okay, my guy George is out running deliveries right now. But when he gets back, here's the list. And, you know, third or fourth on the list, he'll get to you. So just try to be home. Make sure somebody's home for the next few hours. And I said, great. So we go home. And my wife decides to go to the gym. And I was very, very happy for that because, again, anybody who has a young child knows, like, you don't always get to do things for yourself. So when my wife was like, I really could just, like, go stretch out and move a little bit. I said, go, do it. Baby goes down for a nap. So I'm home alone. And the buzzer rings. Hello? Guy's like, Christmas tree delivery. I go, cool. Elevators to the right, man. I was living pretty well at that point. I had an elevator building. No more walk up, you know, grown up. And I go out in the hall, elevator door opens, and a cartoonish situation pours out of the elevator. This like put upon, stressed out, frazzled like Michael Richards-esque character, like a Kramer-esque, just like lovable dope of a guy. Like he catches his toe on the way up the elevator and he kind of trips into the hallway and then he turns around to drag. They got the, in New York, they call them like the granny carts, you know, like the, those stand up shopping carts that'll usually like fold up flat and then they unfold. And people have those to go grocery shopping because when you're shopping on the city blocks, like you don't have shopping carts. You're not loading things in your car. So he's got the Christmas tree crammed into one of the granny carts and he goes to pull that off the elevator and the tree is too wide. And he's like cartoonish, like struggling noises. And then he finally gets the thing into the hallway, but it has jammed itself through the wiring of the granny cart. So the trunk of the tree is really crammed in there. And he's like standing on the edge of his own granny cart, like trying to hoist the tree out, like, and I'm feeling bad. He's like, no, I got it, man. I got it. And I don't want to be disrespectful because this is what he does. And, but then I finally am down kind of like lifting it, the tree from the bottom, and he's yanking from the top and just like, oh boy, we almost got it. Like he's like one of these guys who's just like, he's just like a train wreck in a lovable way, you know, but in a way where you're going, buddy, how do you make it through the day? So we finally get the tree out. He's like, hi, I'm Georgie. It's nice to meet you. And I'm like, cool. And he's like, yeah, you got the base all set up. I go, yeah, I got the base all set up. He goes, great. I can set it up just a few minutes for you. Then I got you. And he's like, at this point, you know, it's also like end of December in New York, but now he's in that bad combination of like, he's wearing like an outfit for someone who's outside in the freezing cold all day, but he's been straining so much. So now he's also like wiping sweat off his face. Just like a wreck, just a wreck. And he comes in and he gets the tree in the stand. And my wife had a family friend who gave us a gift when Cal was born. She gave us this toy chest that was, it's really nice. It's made of wood and she had his name carved into the side. So the guy's setting up the tree and it's still in the orange net and he's like struggling and you could tell he's like off his game now because the hallway was so strenuous and he's like, he's down on all fours and like turning the things at the bottom of the stand to get it to catch and it's just bumbling. And then he looks over at this toy chest and he just goes, who's Caleb? And I just kind of looked at him and instantly my dad buzzer went off in my head. Like he said it. I don't know how to explain it to you except to say that a different person said it. It wasn't the bumbling dude that said it. He just goes, who's Caleb? And I just kind of like looked at him and didn't answer because I instantly was like, that felt weird. And he goes, you have a son, Caleb, huh? And I go, yeah. Caleb's my son. And he goes, how old is he? And I go, he's not even a year yet. And he's, oh, beautiful, beautiful man. And I clocked it. I was like, this is weird. And then he turns to me and he goes, I'll take the this netting off for you if you got some scissors. And I go to my desk and the scissors aren't there. This is like a constant thing. Scissor placement is one of the things my wife and I have. Every couple has their things. Scissor placement is one where I go, I know that I always put the scissors back in this drawer. And then there's like nine other drawers that my wife will tell me they're actually supposed to be in. And I thought they were on my desk and I can't find the scissors. But what I do have in my life is I have a friend named Eli who I love to death, but he is a lovable dummy. He's one of these guys. He just likes being dumb. He's an intelligent person. But he's just enjoys just being a dummy and he likes dumb stuff. Like he's my friend who we used to go on the road together and he'd like buy fireworks and set them off. And I'm like, we don't need to be buying fireworks in our 30s and setting them off while we're driving through the South. Like, you dummy. I love you, you dummy. Like it's fun, but you're a dummy. And one thing that Eli had done a couple of years prior was he somehow found a thing where he bought like 30 knives, these like big 6-inch blade handle blades with these cheap plastic handles. And then to all our friends, he's like, what color do you want? I'm like, I don't need your weird knife. He's like, take the knife, man. I'm giving all my friends a knife. Bobby got the red knife. Eugene got the yellow knife. You want the blue knife? Take the blue knife. I'm like, why are you buying all your friends cheap pocket knives, you dummy? Like, where'd you find it? And I love this guy. I say that with love. So I couldn't find the scissors, but I go into my desk and I realize I kept this knife in my drawer to like open packages with. So I go, I can't find the scissors. Let me grab this thing. I walk across the room. And I hand this knife to this guy, George. And when I put this knife in his hand, two things happened. One is he looked down at it with the demeanor of an alcoholic who has just had a shot placed in front of him. And I will never forget the words he said, which is he looked at the knife and he goes, "Hello, beautiful," to a knife. He says, "Hello, beautiful," to a knife.
Oh, my God.
And again, he said it in a way where I'm telling you, you read stories about people who are like serial killers, if I'm being honest. You know, or you watch news footage where people go, this guy lived down the block from us and he had three women, you know, that guy in Cleveland where people are like, we all just lived on the block with this guy. He was just like a quiet guy, but he just seemed like he worked hard. And then he's got three women chained up in his house. Like, and then you find out this guy is two different human beings. You know what I mean? Like he was just the deal. He would cut your lawn for you. He'd give you the shirt off his back. And then also he had a sex dungeon, you know, that he dug in the middle of the night. And that's where all those piles of dirt were, you know. Like, and the guy just goes, "Hello, beautiful," in a way where I go, this is not the guy who was out in the hallway. Like, oh, I can't get it. It's stuck. It's like that guy was like the fourth stooge. I guess the fifth if you count Shemp, you know. It was like a Keystone Cops routine in my fucking hallway. And now I hand this guy a knife and he goes, "Hello, beautiful." Like this moment where I just went, what did I just do? What did I just do?
Yeah.
So he's cutting through the netting and he's still not good. It's not like he all of a sudden has become this. He's not teaching a master class on how to set up a Christmas tree all of a sudden. Like he still isn't good at that. It's just a different tone. So he's trying to hack his way through the netting and it's taking forever. And then all of a sudden, and we're in a New York City apartment. So the crib is at the foot of our bed in our one bedroom apartment. And on the other side of that wall is our kitchen. And then it opens right up into the living room where I am with George. It's a New York City apartment. So think of it as the bedroom, the bathroom, and the room I'm in with this guy. And the baby monitor is set up on the kitchen counter. And George is kind of on the other side of that. So this baby monitor is directly between me and George. And all of a sudden I just hear, I could not believe the timing. My son wakes up early from his nap. I just hear, "Nyeh." And George turns and looks at me with this knife in his hand and goes, "Caleb's home." And I just knew in my heart, in that moment, I just went, I might need to kill this fucking person. This person is putting me in a position where he might need to be dead. And I started feeling that. And I'm telling you that. And parent to parent, I'm telling you it in a way where I go, not a hyperbolic thought, not a histrionic thought, just the innate knowledge of like, I handed this guy a knife. When he touched the knife, he reacted like he had just sniffed cocaine for the first time in 10 years. And now he just looked at me and made note of the fact that my son's awake and he's looking me in the eye. And it just hit me. I might need to kill this person. This feels weird and I might need to kill this guy. And it wasn't, it's that weird thing that I think only parents understand where I'm going, I'm not being dramatic. I'll kill him. I'll kill this guy. And I go, "Yeah, he's awake. It sounds like," and he goes, "Are you going to go get him?" And I go, "Oh, you know what? He hasn't been napping that long, George. So I'm going to see if he puts himself back down." And we just kind of looked at each other while my son's crying on the monitor. And after like, you know, felt like forever, but it's probably about a minute. He goes, "I don't know if he's going to go back down. You should probably go get Caleb." And I'm sitting here and I'm going, I don't want to get my son right now. But then I'm also going, you know, maybe some of it is the Catholic upbringing. You never want to offend anybody. Then there's also a part of me going, what's going to create more tension? And I'm sitting here in my head making like snap decisions, but I'm going, in reality, if nothing was weird about this guy, I'd be getting my son right now. So let's do that, because I know that that's the normal thing to do. And he's going to see, you know, maybe he's just a weird guy. So I go and I get my son, and he's doing the sleepy baby on my shoulder thing. And I come out, and George is going, oh, he's beautiful. Look at his blue eyes. Beautiful baby. You're beautiful, Caleb. And I'm going, thank you so much, George. And he's now he's like barely even bothering to cut away at that net with that knife. And I'm just looking at him. And we had in the middle of my apartment, New York City apartments, you can't raise a baby in these apartments. I don't know how people do it. We have since moved back to my native land in New Jersey, but we had like a big baby cage set up in the middle so we could plop him down and he could play. So I just put my son down in the middle of the baby cage and I put my back to my son. I'm directly between my son and this man's view of my son. I just look at him. I go, hey, you know what, man? Like, he's awake. I got to deal with him. So you got the thing almost all the way off. I'll finish taking the net off. And George then proceeds to make a choice where I will tell you he ruined a piece of my childhood and I think my son's childhood forever. This guy, and I wish I could do the voice, proceeds to look at my son and go, do you like George? In a Donald Duck voice, like a nightmare Donald Duck voice. He starts going, Caleb, do you like Georgie? Oh, do you like George? And my son, who is a sweet boy, who's not, he can be a shy kid, but he wants to have a good time. He's a nice, sweet, well-intentioned boy. He really is. He goes, Caleb, do you like George? And my son bursts out crying quicker than he ever has after one sentence from another human being. I've never seen my son instinctively react more poorly to anyone than this knife-wielding Christmas tree delivery man who's decided he's going to impersonate Donald Duck. So I go, oh, he's just waking up, George. Don't take it personal. And he goes, I guess he doesn't like me. I don't know. Kids don't like me sometimes. I go, do you have kids? He goes, no, but the kids I meet, they don't like me. And I'm going, whoa, that's a scary thing to say. This is a scary thing to say. So he keeps doing the Donald Duck voice. And my son's just looking at him. And George walks up to the edge of the baby cage. And he's doing this Donald Duck voice with my son. And it hits a point where I'm sincerely, I can tell you, sincerely going, okay, he's now close enough to my son that I don't want to step over to the kitchen area to get a butcher knife. I guess this, he's got his shoulder towards me. I don't know which hand he has that knife in. I think if I take about a, if I start floating back now, he won't notice that I'm getting, trying to get behind him. I guess I might just choke him to death. And I'm sitting here legitimately going, I think probably that's it. Yeah, I don't think I have time to get my own weapon, so I'll probably just try to fucking choke him to death. All in front of my young son, my not even a year old son. This kid's 6, 7, 8 months old, maybe April to December. So I'm sitting here going, I could kill this guy. And it's really hitting a porch where George is going, wow, he really doesn't like me. Caleb really doesn't like me. And I finally just turn to him and I go, George, I got the tree. You're going to go now. And it was this moment where he could tell, I don't know, who knows? Who knows? Maybe he's just a weird guy. Maybe he's just a weird guy who had a long day and he's tired from dropping off trees. Or maybe he was a guy who did in fact have these different personalities inside him and that I suck him. Maybe I was just a dad who hadn't slept in 6 months and was seeing more than there was. I don't know. But what I do know is when I said that, he turned and he looked at me and there was this beat where it really felt to me like I might as well have just said, like, I'm calling your bluff, dude. It's time to go or it's time to make your move. Like, that was my tone. And he just looked at me and he was like, you sure you don't want me to finish that net? And I go, no, I got the net, George. You're going to go now. And I tip him. I put the tip in his hand because I had the tip in my pocket because I had been told you got to tip out. So I knew. I go, I'm tipping this guy. That's when you leave. Nobody's sticking around after they get their tip. Not in New York City. People got other places to do. You got other trees to drop off, man. So I put the tip in his hand. I go, I got the net, George. It's time to go. And we have this like slow walk back to the front door. And it was like the most tense 10 seconds. I've never even really told my wife. She came home later and saw how scared I was. I've never really told her how scared I was, though, because I'm still sitting there going, float like a step and a half behind this guy. Don't walk shoulder to shoulder, because if he makes a move, you want time to react. Like, I'm honestly thinking things like this. And we get to the front door and I open it and I go, thank you so much. And he goes, yeah, bye, man. Bye, Caleb. And he wasn't even 2 inches away from the door, and I slammed the door shut and I throw the deadbolt. And anybody who's been in a New York City apartment building knows, like, you hear the deadbolt. And I throw the deadbolt, and I tell you, I waited about 5 seconds of just like letting out a breath, going like, the fuck's going on? And then I looked through the peephole, and my door was right next to the elevator. And here's where I swear, there's two things that I will end the story on where I will swear to you, I wasn't wrong, and I almost had to kill a guy. I think I came a couple minutes away from either dying or killing a guy. I was on the third floor. He had that granny cart with him. It took a minute for that elevator to get there. The elevator always waited at the bottom floor. I waited about 5 seconds. I looked through my peephole. He had taken off for the steps. He got out of there. He knew I sensed something was up with him, and he grabbed that thing and he ran. He didn't wait for the elevator. He got out of there too. And the other thing, I have searched my house high and low. I have moved since this story took place. I unpacked everything in that desk because we got rid of that desk. I boxed up the stuff I wanted to keep. I threw out everything. I have not seen that blue knife since I put it in that man's hand. And I have never been able to hear Donald Duck again. My son has some Mickey Mouse bath toys. I put the Donald Duck one away when we got it. He can play with Goofy and Pluto all he wants. Don't put the fucking, he can play with Daisy Duck too. Donald Duck is not going in the bath with you. And I tell you, I learned in that moment. I might kill and you might die, George.
You know, I hear this story that first of all, it's such a great fucking story. First of all, you know what that should be? It should be a play, a two-man play. It just sounds like, and it's almost like, remember The Burning Bed, how good that was with Farrah Fawcett? And it was just that room. It was just really one room, one set. I could totally see this as a play, you know, the Christmas tree, you know, the delivery. So, you know, the name of the show, the name of the play, the delivery. And it's just two men in this standoff, because it's so, the reason why it was so scary is because Of course he could have been a murderer. Of course. Like, why not? This is exactly how it goes down. Somebody lets him in the apartment. You think he's okay. And he turns. I mean, this is like, you were legitimately scared. And I think you should have been. I mean, I would have been.
What do you think? Clearly, I think, you know, any situation where you feel in danger and you wind up safe, you played it right, I think. That's the goal, right? Stay safe. In my case, keep my son safe. I do often look back and go, there's a few times where I really wonder if I should have been, I had an instinct to restrain or fight this guy at some point. Do you think you would have hit a breaking point in there?
I would have said much earlier, you need to leave now. I would have said it very strongly, and I would have said it like very confident. I think I would have. I would have tried to be right in his face and say, okay, now you need to leave. You know, or here's the money. Here's your tip money. You need to leave. Like, just I kept wanting you to just leave. And I kept thinking, like, why are you delaying? Especially when you had basically an out-of-body experience and you saw what was going on. There was a red flag warning, you know, because you said to yourself, well, if this was not a problem, I would just run and get my son.
Yeah.
But you didn't. So it's kind of like, you're probably a little mad at yourself that you let it go as far as it did.
When that guy was at the edge of that baby cage, I was going, man, this is on me. This part's on me. Like he's within reach out and pick him up distance right now, and that's on me. And that is when I really was like, do I charge him and try to just like truck him into the, he was in front of our sideboard. I'm like, do I try to truck him as hard as I can into that furniture? Do I go right for a choke? What do I do? Because he's within reach out and pick him up distance. If he reaches for Cal, what do I do? That's when I was like, this is my fault. And this might be trouble. It was bad. It was scary shit.
Yeah, no, it's definitely the real deal. And let me make an educated guess. Now you do have a fake tree.
We have a real tree, but if I wind up covered in needles and saps now, happy to take that hit myself.
Yes, so be it. Throw the goddamn tree on top of the car now and just get where you need to go. That's so crazy. Great story. Thank you so much for sharing it. Chris, really, this is, it's intense and really exciting. I'm telling you, I think this needs to be like written somewhere as a two-person play, because the guy is such a scary character. And by the way, when he made that Donald Duck, you know, voice, et cetera, I kept thinking he sounded like the It Clown.
If I was better at characters and stuff like that, when I say he was able to do a pitch perfect Donald Duck, I'm not kidding. Like, he was talented, at least at that one thing. He had a real ability.
It's so creepy.
I know.
I
I wish I could do it as well as him, just to recount the story, because to hear a pitch perfect Donald Duck come out of the mouth of someone you were suspecting might have very sinister intentions was the last thing I expected. And I'm almost mad for the sake of the story that I can't do a good Donald Duck, because I was that point, I was just like, that was like, I'm going to shit my pants. What the fuck?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, no. It's like, oh, no.
Don't even look at my son, you filthy. You know, there's such an animal instinct. And you think about the mama bear and the cubs and all that. It's very real. It's very real. Oh, we're all animals, and it's very instinctual that you would, of course, throw yourself in front of you. Of course, you'd have to, you know.
Well, I guess it goes to show that, you know, when you're buying a product from someone who's driven from Northern Canada and who's sleeping in a van for weeks at a time, and then you let someone they just found into your house, like, that's the random Canadian in the van found this guy, George. That's how off the grid George is living. He's working for tips under the purview of a Canadian van dweller. And now he's been in my house for 7, 8, 9, 10 minutes. My bad. Leave it in the hall, George. I'll set it up.
Hey, it's Christmas season. Time to go on down to New York and set up our, you know, that is just such a funny picture. But I get it. I get it. They got trees. They got time. They need to make a buck.
Yeah, they need a guy to drop them off. And they found a dude willing to do it. Probably fair to say George is not someone who likes to file paperwork or have authorities know where he is at any given time.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. He probably doesn't even have a phone, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
All right, listen, you guys, we got to wrap it up. But I want to tell you again, head over and watch Half of My Life. You can go to chrisgethard.com. Is that how we click through to Half of My Life?
chrisgeth.com. And
It's Chris Geth. So it's CHRISGETH. ChrisGeth.com.
Yes.
Okay, great. And then, of course, we can find you over at Twitter at Chris Gethard.
Mm-hmm. And Instagram at Chris Geth and all those good things.
Yep. All that good stuff. And again, listen to New Jersey is the World. And I don't even think we talked about Planet Scum Live. Oh, you do another show, Planet Scum?
Yeah. I do a show where if you guess 40, at this point, I think it's 57 items spread throughout four different boxes, you win $4,600. It's a real weird show, but a very fun time. Very fun.
Chris, that is such a funny premise. And when do we see that? How do we watch Planet Scum? On YouTube?
That's on Twitch. Planet Scum Live at Twitch. It's on Wednesday nights. But Planet Scum, too, I'm really proud of it. We built a whole platform. We have all different comedians doing shows. We built kind of like an online platform for the pandemic for comedians to do shows, and a lot of great people have been doing stuff there. So.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. I didn't know that. You know, I've had my storytelling show and my game show going all through the pandemic. It really did bring out people being awfully creative, you know, in terms of getting our stuff out, you know?
And yeah.
I think in a way, well, for sure, there's going to be virtual comedy forever.
Yeah. A lot of it was cringy, but then the stuff we all figured out that actually works, you're going, oh, this is just a part of my career now. Because yeah. Why wouldn't it be? So another silver lining.
That's right. See, we got those too. All right, you guys, thank you again so much for tuning in. This has been a blast. And listen for the anniversary shows coming out this month in July. I've got 3 anniversary shows coming out with my favorite 11 stories over the last 11 years. And you'll hear from fabulous comedians like Theo Von, John Reap, Bert Kreischer, Kelly Carlin, Erica Rhodes, and I guess 6 other people. Yeah, that's right. 11. And it's a lot of fun. And so check it out, you guys. And again, big thanks to Podcast One for picking up Storyworthy. I think we'll have a fruitful relationship. All right, you guys, one more time on behalf of Chris Gethard. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, everybody.
My name is Christine Blackburn saying, make it a Storyworthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.